Gentlemen, start your engines!
Booster.
Go.
Retro.
Go.
Vital.
Go fly.
Guidance.
Guidance, go.
Atomic batteries to power.
Virgin.
Go fly.
Ecom.
We're go fly.
GNC.
We're go.
Telmu.
Go.
Control.
Go fly.
Turbine speed.
Procedures.
Go.
Inco.
Go.
FAO.
We are go.
I'm completely operational and all my circuits are functioning perfectly.
Network.
Go.
Recovery.
Go.
Capcom.
We're go fly.
Time circuits on. Flux capacitor. Flexing. Engine running.
Launch control, this is Houston. We are go for launch.
Let's rock and roll!
Ready to move up.
Engage.
Have fun storming the castle.
Live from the bunker, the show that's at least more interesting than watching paint dry. It's Sci-Fi for Me Radio.
Book month continues here on Live from the Bunker. Jason Hunt here, and we are wrapping up, I think, our last interview of the month tonight with Amy Pascal. She is an MTV director. She's in the promotions department there at MTV, and she has written a book. And it is a book that I think a lot of science fiction aficionados will read and enjoy and see about maybe emulating some of the stuff that they read about. It is a biography, Joss Whedon, the biography, with a foreword by Nathan Fillion. Hello, Amy. How are you?
Good, good, good. Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for coming on. And this, I'm about halfway through the book. It's a very interesting history of this guy. For so many fans, Joss is just kind of this everyman who's been out there and has conquered all of his obstacles that he's had to overcome over the years, especially when it comes to shows like Firefly and Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And the story that you tell in this book paints a really interesting picture of this guy. He's not a cookie cutter film director geek like some of us maybe expect. He's been through some stuff. He's got quite a history. So how did you get tapped to do this biography? Who do you know, or what do you know?
Well, the book was a work for hire. Both Chicago Review Press and Orem Press wanted to put the book out. So it was really the impetus from them and their desire that they wanted to put it out. And so they reached out to agents who then sought out different potential authors. And one of which, through somebody that I work with, an agent reached out to me, and because they knew that I was a big fan and I've been watching Buffy since '98 and had been involved in the fandom. So that was in December of 2010. And, you know, as with everything, there was an auditioning process of, you know, writing samples and what our thought process would be, and, you know, what our approach would be to the book and who we were interested in talking to. So I think that I never got the official word of why they chose me, but I am guessing it probably had a lot to do with the fact that I had experienced Joss's work kind of in real time for the past, goodness, 20 years? Is that right? I'm like, oh my goodness, is that really that how long it's been? No, but close to it. And so, and then also, I, you know, have been involved in the fandom. So there were a few people that I could probably reach a little easier. And that's what I know and who I know. But I never got the official word of why me. But I think that was it, and I think, you know, it's just it's been very interesting as I've been working on this to see how many people started watching these shows after the fact, you know, like years right after, and so they binge watch like all season sevens of Buffy and, you know, and five of Angel. So it was, in retrospect, I think it is a great opportunity for to be writing about somebody who is so current, obviously, you know, someone who's still working prolifically, like at this point, but that I could really speak to a lot of the things that he was doing in real time because I remember them. And even if I didn't know the exact thing, I could contextualize it pretty quickly.
Sure. And I think the fact that Joss Whedon has now entered our collective consciousness through the Avengers and the Marvel movies, I think probably even adds to that, that second generation or third generation level of interest, you know, looking at, you know, this huge blockbuster billion-dollar movie, and now people who have seen, you know, Joss Whedon's work for the first time are now sitting there going, well, who is this Joss Whedon guy? Why is he such a big thing? And you are finding people going back and looking at Buffy and looking at Firefly and the fandom that has built around Joss, as opposed to one of his stories or one of his shows, is really interesting to watch, because you don't have a whole lot of those people outside of actors who get that kind of following. You know, Nathan Fillion, okay. You know, Brad Pitt, Angelina Jolie, Johnny Depp. And now you've got Joss Whedon, who's got this same kind of fandom that follows him and watches all of the stuff that he does and is interested in his work. And he's not an actor. He's a celebrity in that same sense, but it's really interesting to see this everyman, this everyday guy, become this star. I mean, he's a rock star among people that are not even really science fiction fans so much as they're just Joss Whedon fans.
I think that's a really fantastic point that, you know, comparing, because I don't know if there's a lot of TV producers. I think now it's a little bit more, I don't want to say accepted, but it's like you look at Shonda Rhimes, you know, and people say, oh, well, I loved Grey's Anatomy, so I'm going to follow her to Scandal. And now I'm going to follow her to, I think it's How to Get Away with Murder.
Right.
But really, especially when Joss was coming up, like, I mean, people knew Aaron Sorkin and Stephen Bochco, but I don't think as many people necessarily knew of specific people in television that was writing and producing.
Right.
And when you were talking about that, comparing, you know, Joss to his writers, you know, I mean, I'm sure there are other people like this, but it reminds me of a Stephen King or J.K. Rowling. J.K. Rowling is actually the first person I thought of, because it's like, yes, people got into her because of Harry Potter, but they may follow her to see what other things she's interested in or what she's talking about in that celebrity way. Like, she became a celebrity because she produced something that people became passionate about. And then maybe they'll go back and look at her other work. I mean, obviously, with Harry Potter being the first thing, but I think it's sorry, I'm losing my train of thought, but I think that's the whole connection of
it happens to me a lot, so don't worry.
but I thought that was a really good point, that, you know, that they are following Joss from project to project because they like what he does, and I think it really does connect to the writer and him. When you first started mentioning it, I was thinking, is there other realms that people will continually follow a single person? And I think, you know, I am a complete comics newbie, but I see the news and people are excited, oh, so-and-so is now writing in this world, you know, and they're excited to go pick it up. I know, just bringing it back to Joss for a second, when he decided to write the Runaways run, it brought a lot of people into the Runaways, you know, world that hadn't been reading it. And so it just kind of broadened it. So maybe people continued on with their world, and a lot of them went back and reread the earlier pieces that, you know, or the earlier run.
Well, and I think too, there's that intersection point where you have Marvel fans who read Joss's run in the comics, and then, you know, they're able to sit there and say, okay, the movie is in good hands because Joss has written this before in the printed format. He understands this world, this realm, and we're all going to be okay. And fans can kind of take a step back and say, okay, it's going to be fine, and we don't have to worry about, you know, Marvel messing up or anything. But on the flip side of that, do you run the risk in any of your conversations with Josh? Did this ever come up that at some point Josh could be like a George Lucas type of filmmaker, where you get to a certain point and you start to get a little blowback, you start to get a little negative reaction? Do you hit a point? You know, did Josh ever seem to indicate that he was looking somewhere down the line and say, oh, I hope that doesn't happen to me?
He didn't really address that. I mean, it's an unauthorized biography, and the fact that he spoke to me as much as he did, you know, was phenomenal, but we didn't get a chance to go into a lot of things in depth, and this was one of them. But I think he experienced blowback with Buffy, you know, and he experienced probably some blowback with Dollhouse and some other pieces. So I don't think he's a stranger to that aspect of it. And also, as a fanboy, I think he's been very sensitive to the fact that he would know that people who are so passionate about these stories, you know, so passionate about the Avengers, are going to be concerned with how someone is taking it on.
Right.
And, you know, and I also think he's very respectful of the history that came before it. Whereas with Lucas, this was a world he created, you know,
yeah.
And I don't know all of like Lucas's things, but I think that there is something about that, you know, when you were the creator of a world, you can just kind of do what you want. And because there is, you know, you imagine this for better or for worse. But I think that Joss was always trying to be very, I don't want to say respectful, but true, like loyal and true.
Sure.
To the stories that came before and the characters that came before. So, and then also, I mean, it is the nature of it is, as much as he's writing the script, he is beholden to what Marvel wanted, because Marvel has these plans, you know, for how they want their movies to roll out. So I don't think that he could make something dramatically different than what Marvel wanted, and so there was kind of that balance there.
And how much of Marvel's overall plan are you privy to that you can share with us now?
Oh goodness, nothing. Absolutely, I am not privy to a single thing. You know, all of the pieces I know either through interviews that Joss has given, or you know that Marvel has given about like their plans going forward. You know, it was, I wish I would be the most magical person in all the land, you know, if I knew what was going on, what Marvel's plans were. But, you know, just, I mean, I know Joss said that when he sat down and talked about, with Kevin Feige about the first script that was written, and he gave his feedback, and when they went back to him and asked him to write it again, he was given, like, they wanted Loki to be, you know, the villain, and they wanted, there were points that they wanted to make sure it hit, and then he constructed a story around that. So,
now your process for writing this book, I would expect to be completely different from writing any kind of a fiction narrative. How long did it take when you first got started on this? Did you have any kind? You had your dog and pony list that was like your Ferrari and pony list, you know, the wish list, the ones that you really, really, the people you wanted to talk to. And then you had the other list that was, oh, these are the people that I'll probably get to talk to. And what kind of a plan did you have to set in place in order to get started on this?
Well, I mean, initially it was a very wide net. You know, there were definitely the people that I knew I could reach out to faster and, you know, pick up some interviews quicker. And then I just decided to ask as many people as possible, especially ones that either, you know, worked with him on very specific projects, or people that I hadn't really gotten a chance, that hadn't done that many interviews initially. Because, I mean, before Much Ado came out, Kai, his wife, hadn't really done any interviews, you know, especially with Joss. And it was at Joss's request, and I am so grateful for that she chose to talk to me, and she's just marvelous. And, you know, and I spoke to her initially just about their relationship, and then later when Much Ado came out, about her role in that and how everything came about there. But my approach was really to find the stories that I could get that hadn't been out there. You know, I mean, Joss is pretty open, and, you know, a lot of his work has been covered. So with, you know, either retrospectives and listicles and things like that, and people like to come and pick up the same things over and over again. So I was constantly trying to strike a balance of still addressing all of the pieces that he's done for people who may not know. Like, it's funny, I've read a lot of reviews. So half of my reviews, the reviews say, well, most people know all of these things. And then I read other reviews of people who are still big Joss fans and say, oh, I didn't know he worked on Toy Story. You know, or I didn't know that he had done this. And so I wanted to find that best possible way of telling a story that in an odd way, almost like working on the Avengers or Serenity with Joss, which is how do you tell a story to that will interest and engage people that know most of the plot points, you know, and still appeal to people who don't know any of them, or only know a few. And so, and the thing that I, my approach to it was, how can I make it as personal as possible? You know, what were the stories that I could get and talk to people about, and, you know, be grateful that they would share with me that they didn't know, because I think it's these little personal moments that really shape people and would shape Joss. And, you know, and it was very interesting as time would go on. And, you know, I started probably doing interviews in February of 2011, but I still had things coming up, you know, late in 2013 that I could say, oh, okay. And I would go and maybe talk, you know, I talked to either Nathan, or I'm trying to think of who was some of my later people, people that were involved with Much Ado, and talk to them, and then find ways that it would go back and fit into pieces that I had already done before, because I could see how, oh, this one moment really connects to here, or, you know, foreshadowed something.
Now, when you're conducting these interviews, I expect that there are certain things that, certain stories that people will tell you that are not necessarily well known. In this book, if you had to pick one, you know, your favorite unexpected, I never knew that about him type story, what would it be?
Oh my goodness.
The one that just really smacked you in the face and went, oh wow, I did not know that.
I can't, you know, and of course my mind is going blank. I should have prepared.
Well, that happens when I put people on the spot like that. I do that.
I really truly love the story that Kai told about meeting him. You know, that she had been traveling cross country with one of Joss's cousins, actually, and they were going to San Francisco, they ended up in LA, and they stopped at Joss's father's house, where Joss was, I don't know if he was still living there at the time, or if he was just visiting, and the way she explained it, you know, and she said that they saw each other, and she said that he, like, it was like the world faded away, and like he just kind of came into her vision very, very strongly, almost like a movie, you know, scene. And that both of these two very loquacious people really couldn't talk around each other. And, you know, and then they went out to eat, and they, again, barely talked, but ended up spending the whole night, and they went out dancing. And, you know, the stories about Joss dancing are always hilarious. But I thought that was just like this really lovely piece, because, you know, Joss often talks about how awkward he is around girls, and I loved that, you know, and he's also so known for his dialogue, or just even his, you know, he's so great off the cuff in interviews. I would say that, and then also Chris Bull, who is his childhood friend, like, shared some really lovely, fantastic stories, and like the cuteness of them being boys, you know, and that they got into a fight, you know, when at school one day, and that's how they became friends, because their teacher made them like sit together, and how they had such a boy friendship. Not, I won't say boy, but just that young age where it's like all encompassing, and they would go get comic books, and they would get heartbroken over, you know, the same turns of events, and they kind of wrote their own fan fiction by staging, you know, action figures and telling these pieces.
Right.
And I just, you know, I got, you know, I fell in love with that, because I think that those are the pieces that, as you said, like, he's this celebrity, and you have these people that have these, you know, Joss Whedon is my master now t-shirts, which are so fun, but it is those, oh, that's right, he is this like person who gets awkward around a girl that he suddenly likes, and this boy that, as we all did, you know, read a story and wanted, you know, either was and fell in love with it in a way that like nobody really expects, and then you just want to keep continuing it on your own. So,
you mentioned Joss dancing. I was down at Dallas Comic Con when all the Firefly cast was there, and Jewel State and Sean Marr talk about, they told a story about a convention they were at with Joss in London, and it was very, very, very late, I think, on the Friday night, and they had been drinking, and so now they're deciding, well, let's go dancing, and Joss apparently had put on, I don't know if he'd put on a wig or no, he had taken some sort of a towel and kind of wrapped it on his head so people wouldn't recognize him. And of course everybody did, but what Jewel came away with that was the fact, what she thought was really nice was the fact that all of the fans left him alone.
Yeah.
And just let him be in the space and didn't crowd him and didn't hound him and didn't do all of that. And it makes me wonder, with Joss being the fanboy that he is, I mean, I'm not surprised that he gets this kind of respect from the fans, that, you know, he's just one of us. And you do get that sense that he's not above everything. He's right there in there with us as fans. And I think that helps with his popularity to some degree.
Oh, I agree. And I think that there's also, you know, the fact that for the most part, you know, if possible, he'll completely have a conversation with somebody that, you know, pops up. And I can only imagine what it must be like for him at cons. You know, I mean, it must be so incredibly overwhelming. But, you know, it's interesting, you know, as I'm reading a lot of the posts that he's either written on, you know, the Buffy message board back in the day or on Weed and Ask. And I feel that he always has this very personable tone and has done this for years. And so it's less of like an actor who you see in and out once in a while, and definitely feels very, I don't want to say disconnected, but there's some that, you know, it's like you see them at a con and you're so excited and everyone just kind of swarms around them. Mm-hmm. Whereas Joss, I think, feels like the person that you could have a great conversation with him, or you could just say, hey, you know, and walk by. And there is that kind of respect to it. But also, at a convention is a different situation because so many people are going to know. But, I mean, just even working in the book, like, half the people in the world know who he is, or maybe not half, but, you know, there's a lot of people who know, and there's still a lot of people who don't. Nice. So I think that there is that flexibility that he has that a lot of people who are more well-known for, like, because they're an actor, the way they look, you know, they're very instantly recognizable. That's a better way to say it. People are more instantly recognizable. I mean, Joss's work, you know, is recognizable, but he may not be.
Right.
And I think that that is, you know, a clue to it. But, you know, going back to the fans and what you were saying, I've definitely seen fans swarming, you know, and I've definitely seen that part of it as well. But I think that there's something to be said for people who were probably, but the London convention, was that a Firefly convention?
I'm not sure. I think it was a general, I don't think it was London Film and Comic Con. I think it was one of the other ones. It may have been MCM, but they were talking as if, my impression was it was a general con, not a Firefly con. But still, I mean, the idea of people just say, oh, well, that's Joss. Okay.
Yeah.
He's here. That's, you know, it's fine. Let him do what he does. Now, the book is out now in the U.S. It hits the U.K. on the 24th, I think you said.
Came out July 24th.
July 24th. Okay. So has Joss given you any feedback now that the book is out? Have you heard from him? Any kind of a reaction?
I haven't yet. I am going to reach out. I mean, I was at San Diego Comic-Con right before it came out, and I know that was the news when he had, I believe he had knee surgery, mm-hmm. and then about a week or so later, they announced that filming on the Avengers had wrapped, so the only thing I could think is this poor man just needs rest, and sure. So I haven't really reached out to his people yet to connect with them, because I figured, yeah, so much is going on, but I plan to do that soon.
Sounds like a plan.
Yeah.
Well, hopefully he will enjoy the book as much as I have. This is it really is an interesting look at his history and some of the things that he had to deal with in developing Buffy and Firefly and the things that we know him for. I was actually surprised to find out that his dad was a television writer. That's something that I didn't know. So it's those little details that are scattered throughout the book that I think are going to make it a real interesting read. And you can pick this up. This is from Chicago Review Press. The book is called Joss Whedon, The Biography by Amy Pascal. And it is available, I would assume, through all of your usual book outlets, Barnes & Noble, Amazon, and the like. And we will put a link in our show notes to all of the relevant sites. Now, Amy, do you have a website?
I do. It is the Amy Pascal, PASCALE, that I had. Someone went and stole amypascal.com. So I went with that one.
All right. So we'll link to that. And you're also on Twitter as Amy Pop.
I am.
All right. Well, we will let you get back to work over at MTV. Amy Pascal, the guest here tonight on Book Month, live from the bunker. And before we head out for the weekend, here is the convention weather watch with meteorologist Brian Busby.
First on this week's list, Fan Expo in Toronto, Ontario, Canada. Friday, partly cloudy, stray thunderstorm, 74. Still a chance of a thunderstorm in the afternoon, 78 on Saturday. Mostly cloudy, more showers, high temperature, 74. PAX Prime in Seattle, Washington. Partly sunny, 76 on Friday, a thunderstorm possible on Saturday, 69. Then a chance of isolated showers on Sunday and cooler, high then 66 degrees. The conference continues through Tuesday of the following week. Monday, turning cloudy, 71. And partly sunny on Tuesday and a high of 72 degrees. Virginia Comic-Con in Richmond, Virginia. Scattered storms on Friday, 85, partly sunny. An afternoon thunderstorm bubbles up on Saturday, high of 89, and about the same on Sunday. High temperature also 89 degrees. And the big one, Dragon Con in Atlanta, Georgia. Partly sunny on Friday, 90 degrees, humid, 88 on Saturday. Thunderstorms move through the region on Sunday in a high of 85 degrees. To round out the conference on Monday, a spot thunderstorm and a high then of 89. Reporting from the nation's heartland in Kansas City, Missouri, I'm meteorologist Brian Busby.
Thank you, Brian. And just a note, we do that every Thursday, the Convention Weather Watch, where we will look at our ever-expanding list of conventions and events over at scififorme.com. If your event is not on that list, let us know and we'll add it. And we check the weather forecast for every city that's hosting an event, as far as we know. Now, we know that list is by no means complete, so go ahead and check that out over at scififorme.com. That's going to do it for us. You can find us all on the social media, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, YouTube, Tumblr, Pinterest, Google+, and you can send us an email if you want to give us a comment, livefromthebunker@scififorme.com. The hotline, 573-42-SCIFI. And you can download our podcasts. You can subscribe through various different services, iTunes, OneCast, DoubleTwist, Stitcher, and through the RSS feed over at scififorme.com. Now, this real quick programming note, we are going to repeat the interview with Ellen Datlow coming up on Tuesday the 2nd. We had some technical issues this week, so we're going to repeat a clean copy of that interview on Tuesday the 2nd here on Live from the Bunker. That's going to do it for us this week. Book month is officially in the can, and I think it was a rather successful month. So I want to thank Amy Pascal tonight for her time, and we will be back next week.
This has been a presentation of SciFiForMe.com. Copyright 2014 by Flaming Dog Media, LLC. All rights reserved. No portion of this program may be retransmitted without the express written consent of Flaming Dog Media. And remember, no matter where you go, there you are.